and the influence of Israel and of Judaism upon Christianity. When we reach the 7th century of the Common Era, Judaism was still vital and vigorous enough, but coming in contact with another civilization, that of the Arabs, it was again able to influence it tremendously. It was able to mold another religion, which is today one of the major religions of mankind, Islam, or Mohammedanism. The Arabs in the 7th century were heathen and idol worshippers, and Mohammed appeared among them and taught them to abandon their idolatry and their superstitions and to worship only one spiritual God. And Mohammed gave these people a new faith, stirred their racial consciousness as it had never been stirred before, and set them upon a career of conquest, both religious and military, which within the short span of one century brought them to the shores of the Atlantic and to the frontiers of China and India. Mohammed was greatly influenced by Jews and by Jewish teaching. There were Jews in Arabia from earliest times, and Jewish tribes lived in Arabia in the time of Mohammed. And Jewish travelers bent on commerce passed through Arabia from Syria and Babylon, Palestine, and Egypt. And Mohammed learned from these Jewish travelers and from his Jewish neighbors about Judaism. He learned about the heroes of the Bible. On almost every page of the Quran, Mohammed's book of revelation, which he gave to his people, which has become the holy book of Islam, on every page of the Quran, one finds sure traces of Jewish thought and references to episodes in Jewish history, often as developed in the later Agada of the rabbis. Mohammed's proclamation of the one God, there is no God but Allah, La ilaha illa Allah, is a restatement of the declaration of the faith of Israel, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The concept of divinity, which Mohammed gave to his people, God is one, spiritual, all-powerful, transcendent, is taken over in toto from Judaism. Mohammed traced the origin of the Arab peoples to Abraham, through Abraham's son, Ishmael. And thereby he established a racial contact between his people and Israel, just as Christianity, through the personality of Jesus, linked itself up with the people of Israel. The early Mohammedans, when they worshipped, used to turn their faces not to Mecca, at first not to Mecca, but to Jerusalem, and thereby indicating that they looked upon Jerusalem as the source of their faith, even as they looked to Abraham as the progenitor of their race. Thus, Islam too may be said to be a daughter religion of Judaism. And insofar as Israel's God concept became the God concept of more than 200 million of Muslims today, Israel may again be credited with influencing yet another vast segment of humanity in its spiritual life and thought. Now, when Islam arose in the 7th century, Europe was already beginning to sink into what are known as the Dark Ages. Rome fell before the barbarian invasion in 476. And the Roman world now became submerged under the tidal waves of barbarian invasions. The rich culture of the ancient world was soon forgotten. Ignorance and superstition set in. The Goth, the Hun, the Vandal, and the Lombard are now the masters of a chaotic Europe, steeped in fear, in war, and in insecurity. And the night, the long dark night of the Middle Ages, which lasted close unto 1,000 years, settles upon Europe. But while the sun of learning, culture, and civilization set in the west, it rose in the east, where the peoples under Islam lived. The conquering Arabs loved learning, and they fostered it. They took over the learning of the ancient Greeks, and they added to it. They fostered philosophy, mathematics, and physics, and medicine, and law, and astronomy. They built universities. And for 500 years, say from 750 to 1250, for 500 years, it is the East, and not the West, which is the seat of civilization. And during these 500 years, from 750 to 1250, most of the Jews of the world lived in lands dominated by Islam. Not in Europe, not in Christian Europe, but most of the Jews of those centuries lived in Islamic lands, lands which the Arabs had conquered. Babylonia, Syria, Palestine, Northern Africa, Sicily, Southern Spain. And the Jews spoke and wrote Arabic. They exchanged ideas with the Arabs. And as a result of this contact, philosophic study was stimulated among our own people, and they produced a number of remarkable philosophers, beginning with Sa'dia, Solomon ibn Gabirul, and culminating in the great Moses Maimonides. Philosophers who influenced the thought not alone of Jewry, but of the Christian world as well. Because the Jews in these centuries of the Middle Ages were in contact not alone with the Arabs among whom they lived, but with the peoples of Christian Europe. The Jews were the great travelers of the Middle Ages. They carried on commerce between the Orient and the Occident, between the Muslim East and the Christian West. Someone has correctly said that in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, most Mediterranean seaports were beehives of Jewish commercial activity. And quite naturally, they became the channels through which the learning of the Arabs, which the Arabs had taken over from the Hellenistic world, from the Greek world, flowed into Western Europe. And this prepared the day for the intellectual reawakening of the peoples of Europe, for the revival of learning in the 13th century. Jews who knew Arabic helped in the translation of the works of Arab scholars into Latin. We are in possession of literally hundreds of works on medicine, logic, philosophy, mathematics, which Jewish scholars in the Middle Ages translated from the Arabic, first into the Hebrew, and then by themselves or by other hands into Latin. And it is through these translated works that the peoples of Europe became aware of the rich cultural legacy of the ancient Greeks. It is through these translations that they came to know again Aristotle, Plato, Euclid, Homer. And this quickened their minds and aroused them from the long centuries of intellectual slumber. Of the Arabian authors whose ideas were incorporated into the body of Christian thought, writes Professor Charles Singer, the most important were Averroes, Maimonides, Avincebron, and Al-Ghazal. Two of these, Maimonides and Avincebron, which is another name for Ibn Gabiro, were themselves Jews, and the other two, Averroes and Al-Ghazal, were perhaps the most widely discussed of all philosophers among the Jews, and their presentation to the West was largely in Jewish hands. It is therefore the case that even apart from their role in the direct transmission of texts, the Jews were of importance in molding the Western outlook in the period of high scholasticism, which was the dominant philosophy of the Middle Ages, and in the period of the early Renaissance. The Jews of the Middle Ages, therefore, were a leavening influence in European thought because they were the carriers of the Arab civilization and the Greek civilization which it inherited to the Western world. As far as medieval philosophy generally is concerned, including scholasticism to which I have just referred, it was thoroughly throughout under Jewish influence. Professor Harry Wolfson of Harvard, at the conclusion of his monumental work on the Jewish philosopher of the first century, Philo, writes, "Medieval philosophy is the history of the philosophy of Philo for well nigh 17 centuries. This philosophy of Philo dominated European thought. Nothing really new happened in the history of European philosophy during that extended period. The long succession of philosophers during that period, from among whom various figures are selected by various historians for special distinction as innovators, have only tried to expound, each in his own way, the principles laid down by Philo." And to the question then, writes Professor Wilson, to the question then, what is new in Philo? The answer is that it was he who built up that philosophy which dominated the Middle Ages. Just as the answer to the question, what is new in Spinoza, many centuries later, is that it was he who pulled it down. So that throughout these long centuries of the Middle Ages, philosophic thought, which was the dominant interest of cultured men in those centuries, was largely dominated by, determined by, the text given by, the philosophy of the Jew Philo, who lived in Alexandria in the first century of the Common Era. Now I'd like to say a word about the contribution of Israel to the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. That movement too, Protestantism, felt the impact of the spirit and the thought of Israel. During the 15th and 16th centuries, the study of Hebrew became very popular among Christian scholars in Europe. You might think that only Jews were interested in Hebrew. In fact, you might think that Jews are not interested in Hebrew. But in the 15th and 16th centuries, very critical centuries in the development of Christianity, during these centuries, the study of Hebrew became very popular among scholars in Europe. This is the period of the humanist revival, the classical Renaissance. And men, scholars, are going back, have begun to go back to the original sources to discover the truths which they were seeking. They began to go back to the original Greek, the original Latin, and also to the original Hebrew, the language of the Old Testament. The classic Renaissance in Germany, where Protestantism arose, expressed itself largely in an effort to understand the Bible, to understand the Bible. And the great scholars of that period, which preceded the Reformation under Luther, they studied Hebrew because they wanted to understand the original text of the Old Testament of the Bible. And because of their knowledge of Hebrew, they were able to challenge the interpretation of the Bible which was officially given by the Catholic Church. Up to that time, it was the Church which said what the Bible meant, which gave the interpretation for the Bible. In fact, the Church was not particularly anxious to have people read the Bible and acquaint themselves with the text of the Bible. But these scholars of the 15th and 16th century began to study the Bible in its original. And because of their knowledge of Hebrew, they were able to challenge the interpretation of the text, the meaning of the Bible, which was given officially by the Catholic Church. And ultimately, they were moved to challenge the authority of the Church itself on the basis of their own basic reason and interpretation, reading of the Hebrew Bible. And Protestantism, as you know, denied the infallibility of the Church and of the Supreme Pontiff, the Pope. And Protestantism placed in their stead the overriding authority of the Bible itself. It may well be said then that the movement back to Hebrew was one of the determining factors in the radical religious reform movement of the 16th century, which we know as the Protestant Reformation. It is amazing what a language, what an influence a language can exert upon an intellectual movement. And Hebrew has done that time and time again. In this connection, it is of special interest to note that in one Protestant sect, the influence of the Old Testament was especially predominant. I refer to the Puritans. Puritanism in England was a reaction against the moral looseness which prevailed in England during and subsequent to the time of Queen Elizabeth. And it was a moral as well as a theologic reformation. And the Puritans turned to the Old Testament for their inspiration and for their authority and made it their very own. It became dominant in their thought, became dominant in their lives. In the history of Israel, these Puritans saw their own history reflected. They very often compared themselves to the Israelites of the Bible. The Puritans gave their children Old Testament names. They adopted the very speech and idiom of the Old Testament, and they became steeped in its thought and its mood and its ethical discipline. And their passion for freedom, the passion for freedom which the Puritans manifested in England and which led them to behead a king and to establish a commonwealth in the middle of the 17th century, that passion for freedom they derived directly from the pages of the Old Testament. The great historian Lecky makes this incisive observation. I quote it for you. It is at least an historical fact, he writes, that in the majority of instances, the early Protestant defenders of civil liberty, derived their political principles chiefly from the Old Testament, and the defenders of despotism from the New Testament. The rebellions that were so frequent in Jewish history form the favorite topic of the one, Puritans, defenders of civil liberty, the unreserved submission inculcated by St. Paul, of the other. This is a Christian estimate, not mine. Now, when the Pilgrim Fathers, this brings a little closer to our own history here, when the Pilgrim Fathers, who were the heirs to the spirit of the Puritans, came to these shores, they brought with them this Hebraic love, this Old Testament love of righteousness and earnestness and sanctity. And they builded their new world commonwealth on the model of the Old Testament. And when in the latter half of the 18th century, the American colonies revolted against England, their spokesmen and spiritual leaders sought and found their authority for the revolution, which is unknown in those days, revolution against royalty, found their authority for the revolution in the pages of the Old Testament. Moses leading the children of Israel out of Egyptian slavery, Samuel admonishing his people not to ask for a king, Nathan denouncing King David, Elijah denouncing King Ahab, Jeremiah denouncing King Zedekiah. That was their authority. It's of interest to note that the first seal of the newly established government of the United States, after the colonies won their independence, they made a seal, an official seal, and the first seal carried upon one side of it the figure of Moses leading the children of Israel out of Egypt. And on the Liberty Bell, which is now in Philadelphia, the American revolutionists inscribed their faith by borrowing words from the book of Leviticus, the third book of the five books of Moses. Proclaim liberty throughout the land and all the inhabitants thereof. So that down to the very close of the 18th century, you find this ferment of the spirit of Israel still active, still leavening, still powerful in the molding of the thought and the history of men and of nations. Now, what are the contributions of Israel to the modern world, to our own day? I've traced a long stretch of time from the days of Abraham, 38 centuries ago, one people, living, creating, molding civilization. What are the contributions of Israel today? I should like to dwell a moment upon the contribution of Israel to the economic life of the peoples of Europe. Israel made essential contributions to the economic institutions of the European peoples. In the development of modern capitalism, Israel played a decisive role. Because of his international connections and because of his constant migrations, some involuntary as a result of expulsions, and some quite voluntary at the behest of trade and commerce. The Jew in the Middle Ages became a leader in commerce and trade. And the feudal system contributed to the development of capitalism among the Jews. Jews were excluded from the three estates of feudalism, that is, the clergy, and the noble, and the commons, into which feudal society was organized, and so the Jews concentrated on commerce and trade and the professions. And the Jew was forced out of many activities in which he normally might have engaged. So he was more or less restricted to the one occupation of money lending. As a result, the Jew became the banker of the Middle Ages and developed nearly all of our modern agencies of credit and exchange upon which commercial life today is built. He originated a system of securities, the discounting of bills, and he played a large part in the founding of the stock exchanges in Europe. And this is interesting. And just as Jews played a major role in the development of modern capitalism, banking and credit and corporations, so did they play a major role in the development of socialism, the very antithesis of capitalism. The classic textbook of modern socialism was written by a Jew, Karl Marx. Leninism, or communism, which is today triumphant in half of the world, is a detailed copy of Karl Marx. His was the blueprint, and he was the father of the famous Communist Manifesto in 1848. Now, we may not like Karl Marx. We may not like communism. But here is a Jew who has influenced half of our world today. And half of the peoples of the world today have organized their economic life and existence by his thought. Thus, in both spheres of economic thought, in capitalism and in socialism, Jews played a most decisive role. And in passing, it might be said that for the sins of both, the sins of capitalism and the sins of communism, the Jewish people was made to pay a terrible price in our day. It should be remembered that our people won their political enfranchisement very late in modern times, only with the advent of the French Revolution. That's not long ago. And yet, in spite of the legal disabilities and the restriction of educational opportunities, in spite of being ghettoized and isolated from the surrounding cultures of the day, the Jewish mind continued to function creatively in almost every sphere of human thought right through the Middle Ages down to our very day. Take Spinoza, I referred to him a moment ago. If the English people have a right to claim credit for Hume and Berkeley, and the French for Descartes, and the Germans for Immanuel Kant, then the Jewish people certainly had an equal right to lay claim to Spinoza. Spinoza was a Jew, born a Jew, educated as a Jew. His first books, the first books which he studied, were Hebrew books. The first contact with philosophy, his, was through the works of Hebrew philosophers which he studied. And no man influenced European thought in the last 300 years than Baruch Spinoza. Spinoza's thought was essentially Jewish in spite of the fact that the Amsterdam Jewish community excommunicated him There were political reasons for that excommunication. But Spinoza's theocentric thought, thought centered in God, his exalted ethical idealism, his noble faith in the dignity of human life, and in the capacity of man to rise to limitless heights of self-development, these are fundamental Jewish concepts in line with the best tradition of Jewish thought. I mentioned Spinoza. It was a Jew, David Ricardo, who founded the science of political economy. It was a Jew, Lazarus, who founded the science of racial psychology. It was a Jew, Freud, who founded the science of psychoanalysis. It was a Jew, Michelson, who pioneered in the field of mathematical physics and discovered the speed of light. It was another Jew, Albert Einstein, who ushered in our atomic age. And were one to attempt to enumerate the role which Jewish physicians played in the science of modern medicine, one would need more than an hour merely to enumerate the names of those who contributed vital discoveries in this sphere. A sphere, by the way, in which Jews have been preeminent from earliest times. And one finds Jews today in the forefront of the arts, decorative arts, pictorial, plastic, music, dramatic arts. And in science, there's hardly a branch of physics, or chemistry, or mathematics, or astronomy in which one does not find Jews in the very front ranks. The number of Jewish Nobel Prize winners far exceeds their proportion to the total population. And what is equally important, in the revolutionary uprisings in the last 100 years, when peoples struck out for their political liberation, for their national liberation, in Hungary and Austria and Germany and France and Russia, one finds sons and daughters of our people among their most honored leaders and heroes and martyrs. Of them, it might be said what the foremost German lyric poet Heinrich Heine said of himself: "Whether my songs are praised or blamed matters little to me, but on my grave lay a sword, for I was a soldier in the war for the liberation of man." When you realize, when you stop to realize, that our numbers, our numerical strength, is always small, that our numbers are still relatively few in comparison with the vast population of the world, and when you reflect upon the extraordinary contributions which Jews have made to the sum total of human knowledge in modern times, you become filled with a sense of pride. And I'm sure that it was the inbred Jewish love of learning, the priority which our people always gave at all times to study and education, from the early centuries before the Common Era. It was decreed that every Jewish community, every Jewish town must have a school and a teacher. And a town which did not provide for schooling for everybody, rich and poor alike, and for a teacher, was excommunicated, was placed beyond the bounds of the nation. The priority which our people always gave to the study and education, the centuries of training which the Jewish mind received in schools and Talmudic academies and yeshivas, helped to nurture their intellects and to sharpen as well as to satisfy their intellectual cravings and appetites. It is a virtue of which we may well be proud, something which has been part of the pattern of our lives right through the centuries. collectively as a people, Israel's greatest contribution to mankind, I believe, has been its constancy through the ages to two fundamental ideas, God and moral idealism. If there is one strand which runs clear and discernible through the entire tapestry of our people's history, it is this: God and moral idealism. In the ancient world of idolatry and superstition and slavery and despotism, Israel preached God and morality. In the Greco-Roman world of decadence, Israel preached God and moral idealism. In the dark ages of cruelty and fanaticism and ignorance, Israel held aloft the torch of God and moral idealism. And in the modern world of materialism, of bitter racial and economic strife, the choicest sons of Israel still hold aloft the ideals of God and moral idealism. And this unbroken spiritual ministry, this heroic prophetic persistence through the ages, is perhaps Israel's greatest gift to mankind. And it is my conviction, and with this I conclude, that only as we remain true to these two superlative ideas of our heritage, God and moral aspiration, that we shall continue to play a vital role in civilization in the days to come. Wherever wrong is enthroned, wherever injustice devastates life, wherever tyranny oppresses mankind, wherever hate sets man against man, now you know how much of that there is in our world today, there the sons and the daughters of our people should find their instant challenge. Wherever materialism threatens to dominate human thought, wherever moral laxity sets in, wherever self-indulgence and vulgarity begin to make life ugly and desolate, and there is so much of it going on in our world today, their Jews should be found not imitating, not copying, not following along. Their Jews should be found, Jews conscious of their heritage, of their covenant, of their traditions. Their Jews should be found in the very front of the attack. And in this sense, and in this sense only, can Jews claim to belong to a people chosen and set apart by destiny in the plan of the Almighty in Am Segula. When I behold Jews today trying to compete with the non-Jews, not in the fields of intellectual pursuits, which is the admirable, and the things which contribute to human progress. But when I find them competing with the non-Jew, trying to outdo and outplay and outbuild and outshine and outdrink and outdivorce them, and I feel that somehow they have lost contact with the heroic spirit of their race, that they have dissolved the ties of spiritual kinship with the giants of their race, with the genius of their race. Even a brief scanning of our history, as I have tried to give you these last two lectures, even a brief scanning of our history is sufficient to convince men that in spite of tribulations and dispersions and persecutions, our people has exercised a mighty, a monumental influence upon civilization. In them, the ancient prophecy has been fulfilled. And the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples as dew from the Lord, the showers upon the grass, unlooked for and unawaited by the sons of men. Our people has been in the midst of many peoples as dew from the Lord, the showers upon the grass, fructifying, giving life. And I'm also convinced that our people has not yet said its last say in the world, nor bestowed its last blessing upon mankind. Rome is dead. Greece is dead. And so is Babylon and Egypt. These peoples whom we knew thousands of years ago, mighty and powerful peoples, are dead. But Israel lives, affirmatively and creatively in the world to this very day. And so as Jews, my dear friends, we have two things to do in the world. If we want to remain really active members this historic community which has meant so much to mankind. We don't want to remain merely as dead limbs, Jews just because we were born Jews. As Jews, we have two things to do in the world. First, as individuals, we must see to it that we are always marching with the best and most advanced thought of the world. That we develop ourselves to the highest point, mentally and spiritually and morally. Our strength through the ages has been the strength of ideas. Our fortress was never the moated castle, never the armor of steel. It was always the fortress of the mind and the heart. There no hostile armies, no bigotry, no intolerance, no persecution could reach us. There we were immune, impregnable. And our security in the future must lie in the self-same impregnable citadel, the mind, the heart. We must never put our trust in possessions, in wealth, in numbers, or even in the goodwill of our neighbors, because these are shifting and inconstant. As in the past, we must put our trust in intellectual commitments and in spiritual, moral, ethical dedications. There we are indefeasible. There we are, an Am Olam, an eternal people. And secondly, we must exert ourselves to the utmost to establish in our world and to build into the structure of society the two life motives of which I spoke a moment ago, which emanated from the very soul of our people, God and humanity. We must lift that torch high through the darknesses of the world under all conditions and circumstances. Sometimes that is extremely difficult and fraught with danger. It's not of easy things or simple things. I speak to you, it is not for easy things or simple things that our people has persisted through the ages. That is our sacred covenant, and that is the compulsion of our mission. And the world needs these truths today as much as it needed them in the pagan world or in the Greco-Roman world or in the Middle Ages. Men have drifted away from them. Men have drifted away from God. They've drifted into a neo-paganism. They have placed their faith in the creations of their own hands, in the power of scientific machines, in misapplied applied sciences. And these machines are now turning upon them, ready to rend and to destroy them. The world needs God today as it never needed him before, faith in God. And the world today needs the Jewish ideals of justice and brotherhood and peace more than it needed them at any time in the past. The struggle which has now engulfed our world and which is threatening to destroy the economic struggle, the struggle of the masses against the classes, of the dispossessed against their exploiters, can only be resolved by applying not increased armament, not additional atomic bombs or hydrogen bombs, can only be resolved by applying courageously and quickly, quickly and courageously, Israel's ancient code of moral sanity, of justice for all, and fairness for all, and freedom for all, and peace for all. So, my good friend, a marvelous heritage is ours, and a marvelous history. But I believe that an equally marvelous future awaits us. And if we prove ourselves worthy of our great past, we shall be found worthy also of a great future.